You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms
and conditions. 18 plus. We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey folks, got big plans for the new year? Maybe you're ready to finally launch a small business, start a blog, or promote your favorite passion project. Well, in this day and age, it doesn't exist if it doesn't have a good-looking professional web presence. Luckily, Squarespace makes it easy to turn your idea into a unique website. Showcase your work, publish content, even sell products and services of all kinds in just a few clicks. You can customize everything from the look and feel to settings and products using beautiful templates created by world-class designers. And there's nothing to install, patch, or upgrade ever. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code KICK to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Again, that's squarespace.com and offer code KICK for 10% off. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. I'm happy to welcome back to the podcast an old friend of the show, the ultimate skeptic, Dr. Michael Shermer. Dr. Michael Shermer is the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine, a monthly columnist for Scientific American, and a presidential fellow at Chapman University, where he teaches Skepticism 101. He's the author of the New York Times bestsellers Why People Believe in Weird Things, The Believing Brain, Why Darwin Matters, The Science of Good and Evil, and The Moral Arc. Now he's followed them up with his latest book called Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality, and Utopia. And on today's show, Michael Shermer reveals that heaven actually has a history, and it's probably not what you think. He proves that out-of-body experiences are nothing more than hallucinations, and he questions why all the reincarnated souls only seem to hang out around India. He shares why it's unlikely that you or anyone else will ever live past 125, why utopian societies always end badly, and why science's attempts to cheat death, from uploading your brain to a computer to freezing your body for later, still have some major kinks to work out. Plus, skeptic Michael Shermer talks about his unlikely friendship with Deepak Chopra. He weighs in on Trump's ongoing battle with the truth and settles once and for all whether the body of Walt Disney is somewhere cooling his heels in a freezer. Coming up with Michael Shermer in just a moment. Dr. Michael Shermer is the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine, a monthly columnist for Scientific American, a best-selling author, and a presidential fellow at Chapman University, where he teaches Skepticism 101. He's written a new book called Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality, and Utopia. Michael, thanks for coming back to the podcast.
Oh, good to be back.
Before we get into this new book, I want to ask about this class that you teach. What kind of things do you try to instill in your students in Skepticism 101?
Yeah. Well, so first of all, it's Chapman University. It's a liberal arts school. So all the incoming freshmen have to take one of these sort of critical thinking type courses. And they vary, you know, greatly across the board. You can only have a maximum of 25 students. So they're seminars. And so I'm basically could teach anything I want. So I thought, well, critical thinking, this is what we do at Skeptic Magazine. This is, you know, so really the Skepticism 101, it's just an extension of Skeptic Magazine, what we've been doing for the last quarter century. So I have them all, they have to all do an 18-minute TED Talk. So it forces them to organize their thoughts in a short period of time on one topic. Just have one thing, one story that you're going to tell. And then they have to write an op-ed piece as if they're communicating one idea in a newspaper. Anyway, all this is forcing them to think about things that, you know, critically. And we go through all the usual suspects, you know, cognitive biases and how thinking goes wrong, logical fallacies. But then I have 25 students, so we get 25 topics, you know, Bigfoot, UFOs, aliens, conspiracies, to the Mandela effect. This seems to be a popular one among the kids these days. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of these topics. I give them hundreds to choose from. So we really get it. And they have to present the case, what's the best arguments for the claim, and then, you know, what's the skeptical perspective on it. And then they have to, like Snopes, say whether it's true or false or who knows. And mostly they pick, you know, that it's, you know, they debunk it. Bermuda Triangle, things like that, that are pretty low-hanging fruit. But it teaches them to think critically. And then, anyway, so that's the course, and it's pretty interesting. You know, these are 18-year-olds, so they, you know, I'm getting them fresh out of high school and training them to think.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's no easy feat.
At that age, do you find that they're more naturally skeptical, or are they more inclined to believe conspiracies?
No, I've been amazed at how skeptical most of them are. Mm-hmm. Chapman's, again, it's a private school, but and it's liberal arts. But politically, it's not super far left. It's kind of centrist. And it's not a very religious school. So, you know, I haven't encountered any like fanatical religious people. If they are, they've been quiet about it. And I make it clear from the beginning, I don't care what you believe. What I want to know is that the beliefs you hold, you have reasons for those beliefs. You can articulate them. So last year I had a conservative Christian. And she made her case for, you know, pro-choice and, you know, all the usual stuff. Yeah. And it's like, good. That's good. That's, you know, those are my positions, but you articulated them and argued for them well. And that's the point of the course.
Huh. Now, and speaking of college, I didn't know this last time we met, but I was interested to learn that apparently you originally started out as a theology major at Pepperdine University, right?
That's right. Yes, I did. When I went there, I was thinking about majoring in theology, and I really wanted to be a college professor. And to do that, you have to have a PhD. To get a PhD in theology, you have to master four languages, Hebrew, Greek, Aramaic, and Latin, and I could barely get through Spanish. So I thought, oh, boy, I'm never going to get done. So, and I got to get a job. And anyway, so I switched to psychology, and that entered me into the world of science. I took biology classes, then I went to graduate school, and I took, you know, a lot of classes in statistics, research methodologies, and ran experiments for 2 years in a lab, and I really got inculcated into the world of science. Mm-hmm. And then I also took courses in anthropology and mythology, and then I went through my Joseph Campbell stage, you know, when he was popular. I realized that that what people believe, and they believe just as strongly as I did as a Christian, depends pretty much entirely on where you happen to have been born.
Really?
I mean, if you're born in India instead of America, you're more likely to be Hindu than Christian.
Sure.
Now, there are exceptions, of course. I'm just talking about generalizations. You know, Christian missionaries go to India and try to convert people. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you might run into a few, but most people are in India. And most, you know, reincarnation, if it's true, the souls are all hovering around the subcontinent of India, waiting for a body to inhabit. Okay, so clearly it was obvious to me that these are culturally bound, socially constructed, people would say today, beliefs, and that it's not that any of them are right or wrong, it's that that's not even really the right way to think about it. They're all wrong from a scientist perspective, but there's something else going on with those stories. What, you know, so I began to be interested in the psychology of beliefs. Why do people hold those beliefs? I mean, what role is it serving in their lives? Mm-hmm. So that's pretty much summarizes my entire career. I have a sort of this split personality. Part of me as Mr. Skeptic, I write a monthly column in Scientific American, publish Skeptic Magazine every 3 months. We got to debunk stuff. This is what we do. And, so I got to find something, articulate what the claim is, what the arguments are, and whether the arguments and claims are true or not. And so that's kind of an activist position. But the other part of me is, you know, well, why would people hold those beliefs? What purpose is it serving in their lives? Mm-hmm. And that to me is the more interesting part. You know, why is, say, pick a recent topic, climate change, people's positions on climate change, so predictable based on political party. Today, when people hear climate change and they're conservative or the Republicans, they don't hear parts per million of CO2 gases or whatever. They hear, big government interfering with my freedoms and anti-liberty. And, so that's what they hear. So, of course, they push back against that. So we've lost the narrative on, well, but we still want to know whether it's true or not, which is separate from the politics of what to do about it.
Does that apply across the board to science in general?
Well, it depends on the topic. So whenever the topic bumps into some political or religious notion, then that's when people, pick sides, so to speak. I mean, no one argues about the germ theory of disease or plate tectonics in geology or quantum physics. These have not been politicized. But if you take something like evolution, which pushes people to start thinking about the origins of humans, if you tell people you have to choose between Darwin and Jesus, Darwin's not going to win out for most people.
Yeah.
Right? So you got to take that question off the table. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the fossil record. We're talking about DNA, talking about genetic similarities across all species. We're talking about, how we know how old the Earth is through radiometric dating techniques. These are all empirical questions that have nothing to do with your politics and your religion. But if you make it have to do with that, then people are going to pick sides.
We were just talking about this idea that truth is now somehow subjective. What do you make of all this with the fake news and alternative facts? I mean, do you feel like you're fighting a little bit of a losing battle these days?
So I saw that I think it was Webster's word of the year was alternative facts for 2017. Before that, the year before that, I think it was fake news.
Yeah.
And then before that, all the way back to 2007, it was factiness. That was my word, factiness.
Truthiness?
Truthiness, Colbert. I just coined a word factiness for my latest column in Scientific American. The question is, are we hitting a crisis point? No, I don't think so. First of all, the fact that we're hypersensitive to the idea that people distort facts for political reasons. Well, they've always done this. This is a very old tradition. It's just become a little more apparent because you have the internet with, instant access to the claims.
But
encouragingly,
don't you think it's a little more brazen?
It's more brazen, yes, in a sense, because we're more polarized.
Mm-hmm.
It's the polarization that has made that seem worse. But I'm encouraged by something of a market solution to the problem, which is fact-checking sites like PolitiFacts. And it's PolitiFacts is the one that has, it's true, maybe true, middle of the road, maybe false, pants on fire.
Right.
Pants on fire is, you're just lying.
Yeah.
And there's a half a dozen other sites like that, Snopes, that, analyze every political speech like during the campaign. Within hours of the speech given, you can go online and see the fact checks of every claim in the speech. That's encouraging. We can do that.
Yeah, if we're not lazy, that's the problem.
Well, yes, of course. So the internet brings us, it's a Janus face. It's good and bad. It cuts both ways. And so you have to use it. But so is the printing press, the same device that prints Mein Kampf, prints Shakespeare. We want the freedom. We want the access. We want the knowledge. What you do with it, that's another question.
Yeah. Since we're talking about this, I want to ask you to apply your skeptical eye to the Trump-Russia investigation. Trump and Breitbart want us to believe that the whole thing is just a hoax perpetrated by the media and, some deep state Hillary supporters in the Justice Department or something. Do you buy all that? Where do you stand on all that?
No, well, this isn't really in my wheelhouse so much, but I do pay attention. I think, obviously, it seems clear enough that Putin was involved in manipulating the election to the way he wanted it to come out, and it did come out that way. Now, I was recently in Moscow for a book event, and my translator for this TV show, Russian TV show, RT, Russian, that's the big network there. He regularly translates Putin into English, from Russian into English, for English viewers of Russian television. And he said they were thrilled when Trump won. They couldn't believe Trump won. It's like, oh my God, no one thought this guy would win. Yay, our guy is in there. So clearly they want him. But he also said they've been kind of disappointed that he's not been the puppet they were hoping he would be for them. Okay, so that's interesting. So clearly, obviously, there was something going on there. No, I don't think it's a Hillary plot. But on the other hand, if there was some smoking gun, where is it? I mean, come on. Mm-hmm. We, you know, they've been dragging this thing for a year now. You know, it's like there's other issues. You know, just fish or cut bait. Give us what happened. Lay it out there and we'll deal with it. Or just drop it and let's move on to other, like North Korea or whatever, something that's more important.
Yeah. 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 I think, who was it? I think it was Mark McKinnon said the other day, he said, even if there is no fire, you know, at a certain point you can die of smoke inhalation.
Yeah. Yes. Well, this will be a test for my thesis in my previous book, The Moral Arc, about moral progress. You know, it sure felt good under the Obama administration. 8 years of this was good. But you know, is this going to be a huge downturn? Well, so far, you know, it hasn't been catastrophic.
Yeah.
So it's entirely possible that our republic is pretty robust, and it's difficult to destroy it from within, no matter how incompetent somebody might be.
Well, you mentioned The Moral Arc. This new book sort of builds on previous themes from The Moral Arc and The Believing Brain. What was your goal with this new book, Heavens on Earth?
Well, yeah, so it's an extension of the previous two books, for sure. With The Believing Brain, I was talking about God, and with Moral Arc, talking about morality. So both of these are from a secular atheist perspective. There's no God. And, you know, morality comes from ourselves, our own species, our own societies, cultures, and so on. Well, what about the afterlife? You know, I mean, it's like the last big question I haven't dealt with in all my previous books. I do have chapters on the monotheism's view of heaven and the afterlife, which they all vary, which is interesting in itself, you know, that history, that heaven has a history. Now, I'm a historian of science by training, you know, cosmology has a history, but there's kind of a sense when you read the histories of cosmology of an unfolding narrative that gets closer and closer to what we think is actually out there.
Right.
It's not like that with the history of heaven. It's just like these are all made up stories and they all vary and change depending on you know, what culture the religion is in.
Even within cultures, I think within Judaism, you talk about how the idea of heaven has evolved over the years, right?
That's right. Yeah.
There wasn't an idea that we would go up into the clouds one day originally.
That's right. I mean, the whole idea of kind of an ethereal soul really takes root after Descartes, because that's when we had the dualistic split in the sense that, well, there's body and mind, brain and soul. Brain and mind, body and soul, corporeal and incorporeal. And that was kind of that split in Western intellectual history. And so after that, then the religions all started focusing on the soul. But there's still sects of Christianity, for example, that think, like Jesus, you will be resurrected physically. Like your body will be in heaven again.
The whole body. Okay.
The whole body. Yeah, which brings up interesting problems. Everything. First of all, what age? How old are you? You know, and some of them have answers. 30.
Oh, really?
Yeah, 30, because Jesus was 30 or maybe 33. Anyway, early 30s. Okay, well, because that's a good time. You're physically fit. So. But there's serious problems with this. I mean, come on. I mean, if God does this and somehow reconstitutes your physical body like a Star Trek transporter, why would you not age and die, get cancer, Alzheimer's, or whatever? Well, he's going to fix all that. Okay, that means we know enough to know now that would mean completely reengineering your whole genome and all your cells. It's not really you. This is a different you, not the you. And also, now I'm 63 now, so if I'm resurrected at age 30, where's all those memories I've had in my last 3 decades? Because I've had some really good memories. And are those gone? No, you get those memories. How does that happen? Because, you know, I'm
so
a 30-year-old brain. And that's why I quote Julia Sweeney in there from her wonderful monologue, Letting Go of God. You know, it's like when the Mormon boys came around to her door and tried to sell her on Mormonism. And, you know, that when you go to heaven, the blind shall see, the deaf shall hear, you know, that whole business. She goes, well, I had my uterus taken out because I had uterine cancer. You know, when I die, do I get my uterus back? And they go, yeah. She goes, I don't want it back. And she said, what if you had a nose job and you liked it? And you don't want your old nose back. Do I have to get my old nose? I mean, okay, these are absurd. But then it gets even worse than that. That is, if it's just your soul, again, what is it a pattern of all your memories? Yes. Okay. Well, first of all, again, I'm 63. So the memories of when I was in my 30s now are very different than the memories of when I was in my 30s when I was 50, and different still when I was 40, and different from when they were unfolding in my 30s. The memories themselves aren't fixed in some kind of sense that they never change. The memories are always edited and changed, which we know from cognitive science is why eyewitness testimony is not very reliable. I don't know if there's an afterlife or not. Nobody does. Okay. I doubt it, but nobody knows for sure.
Now, you say no one's ever been there, but what about these out-of-body experiences where, you know, people walk to the light and all that? What about that? Is that proof of an afterlife?
Well, it's proof that the brain is capable of many remarkable experiences. Yeah. I believe that people are reporting an experience they've really had. The question is, where is the experience? Is it in the brain or out in the world? So, most neuroscientists, of course, don't accept that it's a doorway to some other realm where we go when we die. No, most, because we know that every thought you have is generated by neurons firing, and it's brain chemistry, and you can replicate these floating out of the body, going through the tunnel, white light at the end of the tunnel, and all those characteristics can be duplicated either in like a centrifuge. If you spin, research on these pilots that are spun in a centrifuge, Dr. James Winery is the scientist who does this. And a good portion of them, as they're passing out, have these little dreamlets, as he called them, where they like the tunnel, the white light at the end of the tunnel, they feel like they're floating. And this is just the brain shutting down from the cortex inward. The blood is just being pressed to the center of the brain, and the cortex shuts down in a way, and the visual cortex in the back of the skull, it shuts down in a way that creates this kind of tunneling effect. And you can do it through open brain surgery. This is one of the ways that brains are mapped. Here's how we know what this part of your brain does, because we've gotten permission for these epileptic patients that have these open brain surgeries where they go in and try to find where the seizures are starting and zap those neurons specifically so they don't kill memories in other parts of the brain. So when they're in there, they wake them up and they tap around and it goes, just tell us what you experience when we tap right here. Oh, I just had a memory of my 10th birthday, or, oh, I just smelled onions. You know, so it's kind of one way. Oh,
amazing.
Yeah. Oh, it's very, very dramatic. Huh. Well, one of the ways, the things they experience are out-of-body experience. Like, I'm floating above my body now, whatever you're doing. Well, they're tapping in this little area in the temporal lobes, just above your ears. And, you know, if you to tap around, oh, it's my left leg. Now it's my right leg floating. And, ooh, I'm up by the ceiling now. I'm looking down at the doctors. You know, oh, okay, it's right there. Now, you know.
And so it's all in the brain.
It's all in the brain. And even the people that describe in vivid detail, I review Eben Alexander's book in Heavens on Earth. His book is called Proof of Heaven. So I've met him on several TV shows. Super nice guy. Very smart, Harvard-trained neurologist. He knows more about the brain than I do. So why doesn't he know what I know, which is that, you know, these things are all generated in the brain? And the answer is because it happened to him. And, you know, the colors were incredibly vivid and rich. And
he's just convinced.
Feelings I had of intense love and so on. Well, so, you know, I cite research from Oliver Sacks, who wrote books about weird things that people have go wrong with their brains for pure neurological reasons that he's figured out as a neurologist. And to me, they're indistinguishable from Eben Alexander writing about this. Or I also quote from Sam Harris's opening pages of Waking Up, where he talks about ecstasy, take ecstasy. And all of a sudden, you know, vivid colors and this intense feeling of incredible love for my buddy sitting next to me on the couch, also taking this drug.
And it's a hallucination.
It's a hallucination generated by the drugs. But it's not evidence that, you know, the doors of perception have been opened to this other dimension.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Skeptic Magazine's Michael Shermer when we come back in just a minute. Hey folks, SeatGeek is the smartest, easiest way to get tickets to every type of live event. Whether you're searching for the last-minute deal or need the perfect gift, SeatGeek helps you find the best seats at the best prices, fully guaranteed. I have the SeatGeek app near the top of the homepage on my phone because it's by far the easiest way I've found to shop for tickets. I can be anywhere, and with just a few taps, I instantly find tickets. I love going to concerts, comedy, and Broadway shows, so just in the past month, I've used SeatGeek to buy tickets for John Mulaney's concert and Hamilton the Musical. Now, folks, you probably know how impossible it is to get seats to Hamilton, but SeatGeek hooked me right up with no hassle. I could have literally wasted hours going on different sites and comparing prices from ticket brokers, meeting some guy on a street corner wondering if the tickets are legit, but instead, SeatGeek made it simple for me to get the best deal on the best seats for the hottest show in town in less than 5 minutes. It's designed to make your ticket buying experience easier than ever. SeatGeek even grades every ticket price based on value to help you get the most bang for your buck. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop with confidence. Make SeatGeek your go-to app for finding the best deals on every type of ticket, from sports and concerts to comedy and theater. Best of all, my listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code KICK today. That's promo code KICK for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. And now, back to the show. Now, you also address reincarnation, and I got to say that that's one for me. Just the mathematics don't work out when I think about it. I say that, you know, the beginning of humankind was, say, 100 people or two people, Adam and Eve, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
What happens when the population grows? You know, do some people not have a reincarnated soul, or do five people share a soul? The mathematics don't work out for me.
Yeah,
I don't get it.
I know, me too. Maybe that's just our Western way of thinking about these things. A lot of Hindus don't seem to have trouble with this yet. But we know there's 7.5 billion people alive today. 100 billion people lived and died before us. Where did their souls go? Well, they sort of have answers. Well, they're floating around in this kind of you know, waiting room.
Oh, really?
Waiting for a body to open up.
Really? Yeah. Really? There's a Hindu purgatory too?
Yeah, something like that. or maybe there's multiple souls in a body. Well, it would have to be a lot. Right now, the ratio would be about 14 to 1. So maybe this explains multiple personality. No, that's another nonsensical idea from psychology. And also the obvious geographical determination of belief in reincarnation. Again, the souls appear to hover around the subcontinent of India.
They stay where they're comfortable.
There's not many in Europe and in America, although Hinduism is getting a little bit of a toehold in American culture. One of the phenomena that's going on is the rise of the nuns. We've talked about that, I think. You know, the people that tick the box for no religious affiliation. You know, it's a quarter of all Americans, 33% of millennials. The trend, generational trend, is moving toward like half of Americans will not be affiliated with any religion.
Right. But how many are spiritual?
This is it. They're not becoming atheists. They're not signing up for Skeptic magazine and, you know, buying the Shermer books. You know, they're going to Deepak Chopra, you know, and I've achieved a state of consciousness through meditation and so on. So they're becoming spiritual but not religious. And that word then, you know, means different things to different people. But generally it appears to mean your consciousness exists separate from your physical body and brain. So that such that when your body and brain dies, your consciousness continues on. This is the idea, with or without Ray Kurzweil's computer. You know that it just, you know, in that Deepak world, it just sort of returns to where it was before you were born. Consciousness is, I'll just use Deepak's language, it is the ground of all being. It is the ontological primitive. There's nothing underneath consciousness. The scientific reductionist approach is just keep going underneath, you know, so to molecules, to atoms, to, you know, electrons, subatomic particles, all the way down to quarks, and pretty soon string vibration. That's not where consciousness is. It's somewhere else.
How are you and Deepak these weird frenemies? I don't understand that relationship.
Yeah, like that.
How do conversations usually go between you and Deepak?
They go okay now because we've decided to listen to each other and just respectfully disagree. Okay. Mainly this came back because of my wife, Jennifer, just when she was pregnant with our young son. Now he's 20 months old. You know, she just got curious, looking at different ways to help her pregnancy, and I can't even remember what triggered it. She just asked Deepak, you know, what about meditation or diet or tea? I like my tea. Is it okay if I drink tea? What do you think? He's a medical doctor. Okay. So why don't you and Michael come down to my center and just, you know, do the whole weekend here, the whole long weekend with meditation and the tea and the food and the yoga and the massage. And I thought, oh no, Deepak Chopra, he's the enemy, you know? And she's like, well, you know, why don't you just try it? You know, I'm like, all right, hell with it. I'll try it. You know, and so I just kind of went open mind and just tell me what it is you believe, you know, just articulate it. And I have to say, you know, spending a long weekend at a beachside resort in Carlsbad, California, getting massages and eating great food, if you don't feel better, then there's something wrong with you, dude. I mean, come on. And so I kind of see the appeal for sure. And a lot of his fans are very well-to-do. Successful people that are looking for a little bit more. They don't find it in mainstream religion. They don't want to be atheists. So it's like, okay, this is my spiritual, yeah, but not religious, as they say on the dating site. So I think there's definitely an appeal there. Okay. It's not my thing. I don't like I'm not a meditator.
Really? But, you know, there's all this science supposedly. Now, I had Dan Harris on a couple of weeks ago.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Now there are all these studies saying that there are medical benefits.
I believe it. Absolutely.
Enough to convince you? Yeah.
Well, it's convincing. Okay, so here we get to an epistemological question. We say, meditation works. What do you mean by works? If you say, well, like Dan Harris, well, I may be able to control my anxiety. Okay, mm-hmm. Good. Yeah, I agree. Then it probably works. Not just for Dan Harris. I mean, his point and that of other people like Bob Wright has that book, Why Buddhism is True, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he talks about this, you know, and Deepak has some papers now out, published papers in Nature with Rudy Tanzi, who's a Harvard medical professor, where it definitely has measurable effects on your body. Okay, lower stress hormones, lowers blood pressure and all that. That's all good. But that's different from the question of, you know, is there this other realm somewhere that you go when you meditate?
Right.
And this quantum consciousness is where your conscious being goes after you die or whatever.
Yeah.
Now, Deepak says, well, I agree you have to have a brain to have consciousness. In this instantiation of the world, but that it's like a TV set where the signals are coming in, and without the TV set, you don't know that the signals are there. It's like, yeah, okay, but we know that we're getting signals because there's a network broadcasting them for my TV to pick up.
Yeah.
Where is the equivalent of the broadcaster for consciousness? Okay, there's no answer to that, except, you know, it's everywhere. It's the ground of being. It's the ontological primitive and so on. Okay, at some point we bump into a wall where we just can't test it. Then it's off the page of science. You know, if there's no way to falsify it, then what else can I say other than, I don't know, I doubt it.
Now, you're a psychologist. I wonder, are there ways that humans are psychologically primed to believe in some form of immortality or afterlife?
For sure. So Paul Bloom calls this natural-born dualism. I talk about Paul and his research, his lab in my book, that, you know, you can present little children like 3 years old with a little puppet show. You have a little mouse and an alligator, and the alligator munches the mouse and he's dead. Where do you think the mouse is now? And, you know, oh, the mouse is in this other place and he misses his mommy and he's thirsty and he's scared and, you know, and so on. They just naturally think that something continues beyond the physical body. So Paul thinks this is, you know, we're just basically born with this. And intuition that there's body and soul, brain and mind, corporeal and incorporeal, that's just sort of our natural state. And I think probably the reason for that is that you can't imagine being dead, or you can't imagine not existing, because to imagine anything, you have to be alive. And so this sets up something of a paradox. You know, we know people die. We know death is real. We can see it all around us. But I can't imagine not existing.
Mm-hmm.
And so the closest thing I can figure it would be is not quite sleep, because sleep you have dreams, so there's some consciousness going on there. General anesthesia. I've done this a couple times for major surgeries, and, you know, it's just, you know, 10, 9, 8, boom, boom, lights out, and that's it. You wake up. I have no idea how much time elapsed. No dreams. There was nothing. You know, I've never had that problem where some people are under, but they wake up and they can't tell the doc, hey,
oh,
stop.
Yeah.
Apparently it's a terrible, terrible thing.
Yeah, that's terrifying.
You know, they're intubated. They can't speak. They can't move. But the times I've done it, it's just like, that must be what death is like. It's just lights out and that's it. I don't know what else it could be. Now, if it turns out I wake up and, you know, and I'm in some other, you know, multidimensional realm, and there's Deepak, I went, oh, okay. And Christopher Hitchens is there, and Carl Sagan is there, and Stephen Jay Gould is there, all my old friends. You know, this would be great. I would be happy about that. I don't want my consciousness to cease. I'm not, into this. I don't believe, because I just don't think the evidence is there.
Well, you don't just deal with the religious beliefs about the afterlife and immortality in this book. You also investigate some of the scientific efforts at things like radical life extension, cryonics, this idea that you can upload your mind to a computer chip or the cloud. And frankly, Michael, it sounds like you're just as wary of the supposedly science-based attempts at immortality as you are of the spiritual ones.
The scientists have the same problem. The people that want to copy your connectome and then put it in a computer. you know, upload. This is called mind uploading. It's a big, big movement. And they have the same problem. What's being uploaded? Well, your memories. Which memories? All of them. No, well, but they're not fixed. So there is no you. There's no self in the sense of some fixed entity.
Okay.
There's a pattern that kind of roughly resembles the pattern of you yesterday, last week, last year, last decade, 50 years ago, whatever. But it's a constantly fluid, changing thing. So it really gets back to this is it. You know, really. Everybody, listen, this is all there is, and you're not going to be uploaded into the cloud, even if we could do this, which we can't. I mean, we're not even remotely close to being able to do anything like this. I mean, all the computers in the world couldn't hold just one brain file, a file of all the connections.
You know, really?
It's very detailed, yeah. But, you know, but their argument is, okay, but Moore's Law doubling, you know, give it a few decades, we'll be there. Yeah, maybe. But currently the idea is, well, we, you know, upon your death, we freeze your brain, slice it up, but we have all the all the synaptic connections, copy
right.
them.
Cryonics.
You have this gigantic digital file, then you put it in the cloud or a computer and turn it on. Well, even that, I don't think your point of view would go with it. That is your point of view self. So there's the memory self and the point of view self.
Okay, okay.
So like,
so it would be a different person, kind of.
Right,
or a different
because,
version
because
of you.
Let's say instead of doing it by slicing up your brain and doing an electron microscope and copying every synaptic connection digital file. Let's say 100 years from now we have a sophisticated fMRI brain scan. We slide you into the scanner, copy your brain, upload it into the cloud, put it in a computer and turn it on. Mm-hmm. You're still standing there next to the machine going, well, I'm still here. That's not that, your point of view doesn't suddenly leap into the computer or the cloud and go, well, I'm up here now. No, you're still standing there going, hey, dude.
So it's a different
you're
experience.
You're not me. You're just a copy of me.
Yeah, and I got to be honest. I don't know that I would want to, because what if I have, you know, relatives and people bugging me all the time and asking questions? I want to talk, and I can't walk out the room anymore. It almost sounds like my idea of heaven might turn into my idea of hell.
Yeah,
you're
that's right.
Imprisoned on a computer.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and it's not you anyway. So now there are counter argument to that is that it doesn't matter that it's not you. You point of view, you is still sitting there. You one, you two, copy you, thinks it's you. Yeah, but okay, so this is like Woody Allen's joke. You know, I don't want to live on through my work. I want to live on in my apartment, which is really just the continuity of self from one day to the next. So that's why I go through all the radical life extensionists. They get this. They go, okay, no, I don't want to die. I got to keep the physical body going for as long as possible. Now, the problem is there's an upper ceiling to that at the moment. So it's a myth that, you know, people live twice as long today as they used to. That's not true. People centuries ago lived into their 80s and 90s, hundreds, but just not very many.
Yeah.
So what all modern medicine, technology, health, you know, public health measures, vaccinations, you know, toilets, running water, you know, clean hands, all that stuff. All that's done is get more and more of us up to the upper ceiling.
Okay.
No one's going to break through 120 years without something dramatic happening. And the problem is that something dramatic is not one thing. There's no magic bullet. You know, there's the systems across the board start to fall apart in your, say, mid to late 80s. No matter how healthy you are, you got the best genes in the world, best diet, whatever that is, because we still don't even know exactly what that is. And you've dialed in the right supplements, vitamins and minerals and all that. And even there, we don't even know what that is, you know, beyond the basics.
Well, unless you're like Ray Kurzweil, who like takes everything, like 250 supplements, right?
Yes. If you call that living. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know. And, you know, I did that back in the 80s when I was a bike racer. I tried all kinds of things, you know. So I tried all the mega vitamin supplements. You just piss it out. I mean, it's your urine is like this bright yellow, orange, green, and practically glow in the dark. It's not absorbed by your body. Mm-hmm. Your body is already getting almost everything it needs from just a regular old diet.
Okay.
Now, if you're anemic and you need some iron, whatever, okay, yes, that's true. But most of us, most of the time, if you eat a general, just basic diet, you're fine. You don't need anything more.
Huh.
So the idea of re-engineering the chemistry of your cells through diet and supplements, so far, that's not working.
Okay.
And so the other problem is then the telomeres at the end of your chromosomes, which determine how many times.
Yeah, that was supposed to be our savior there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so there's
lengthen our telomeres.
There's some new books out about the telomere, I forget what it's called there.
Yeah.
Telomere miracle or whatever.
I had her on, Elizabeth Blackburn.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. This is all super interesting research. She's very smart. I love it. Okay, but by the way, let me note parenthetically, I'm not against any of this stuff. I'm only skeptical because—
Yeah, it sounds like you're skeptical of science now.
Yeah, I know. That's what it sounds like, but I'm not. I'm in favor of these guys doing this. I hope they get there before I hit the wall, okay? But the problem is that it's way more complicated than that. Like, for example, on the telomeres, so this has to do with something called the Hayflick limit, which is the number of times a cell can divide before it dies. 50, 60 times or whatever is kind of the average for cells. They vary. But so if we fix it so the cells could divide indefinitely, we have cells that do that. They're called cancer. They divide indefinitely and they never stop. So somehow we got to fix the problem without turning human bodies into, you know, masses of cancerous tumors. And that's not so easy. Now, the Blackburn book, you know, it's like, okay, here's the kind of things you could do that seems to lead to better telomere stability. Okay, that's good. Sleep, it turns out to be one of the best. You know, just a good long 8-hour, 9-hour sleep. Just go to sleep and don't get up until your body just tells you to get up, you know, and diet, exercise every day, you know, good cardiovascular. All that's going to do is hopefully get you into your 80s and 90s healthy, mm-hmm. cognitively aware. You know, so when people say, Shermer, don't you want to live to be 500 or 1,000 years old? It's like, listen, just get me to 80 without cancer, 90 without mm-hmm. Alzheimer's, 100 okay. without being on a morphine drip
quality,
in a bed.
Quality, not quantity.
Quality,
okay.
right. Yeah. And then if we can get everybody there and continue and push on, because there's no point where I'm going to go, yeah, that's it, I'm done, I want to cash out. There are people that do that, and that's why suicides are one of the most common causes of death. But there's specific reasons for that, mainly depression and mental illness. So, but given healthy and happy, physically healthy people, they're not going to want to cash out either. You know, I mean, if you ask people, surveys ask this, how long would you like to live? The answer typically is whatever the current lifespan is. Mm-hmm. Oh, I guess early 80s or so. Okay, let's fast forward to the week before, you know, the average. Are you going to cash out? You know, No. I want to keep going. Yeah. Or if I gave you a diagnosis, you're going to die tomorrow, you know, would you like another week? Yeah, of course I'd take another week. Okay, fast forward 20 years and go, okay, now 20 years, now boom, you're there. Next week you're going to die. No, wait a minute. I need some more time. I'm not done with this project. I have my kid, you know, blah, blah, blah. Okay.
It's never ending.
It never ends, right? Yeah. So there's no really good reason to be against it. Mm-hmm. It's just that, again, we're not there, you know, scientifically, technologically. I hope we do before I hit the wall, us baby boomers. So this is what you got to do to make it count. And then I kind of go through the various things that we know from social science research and psychology. What makes people happy? What makes them feel fulfilled and purposeful? These are the things we could do. We know now what that is. I have a pretty good idea.
You don't only deal with people trying to get into heaven and people's belief into heaven, but you deal with, toward the end of the book, this idea of people trying to bring heaven here, trying to create utopian societies.
Yeah.
It always seems to me that if anyone was ever successful at creating utopia, then it would still be around, it would still be in existence, and we'd all be living there right now
exactly.
because it's so wonderful. Why do they always fail?
Yes. They always fail because of human nature. Mm-hmm. First of all, we have a nature, and it varies greatly across different cultures. So we also have a culture. And people have a wide variety of needs and wants that cannot be met by any one society. So mm-hmm. the question, what's the right society? The answer is there is none. And there never will be.
One man's utopia is another man's dystopia.
Yes, that's right. You know, so the problem with you, this is the utilitarian problem with utilitarianism is, you know, if you're willing to kill the one to save the five, with the mm-hmm. famous trolley experiment, you know, would you flip the switch to send the trolley down a sidetrack to kill one worker instead of the five it's going to kill on the current track it's on? Most people say they would flip the switch. It seems like a reasonable argument until you do the calculus and think, well, okay, what if it's a physician has five dying patients in five different rooms in the OR, and he's, you know, just a healthy person's out in the waiting room waiting for a family member. Should we sacrifice him, harvest his organs to save the five? Well, if you did this, you'd go to jail for murder. You can't do that. And there's a reason for that. You know, we don't want to live in a world where people could be randomly plucked off the street and sacrificed for the good of the many. And then it's too easy to ratchet up from kill one to save five, to kill 1 million to save the 5 million, or kill the 6 million Jews in order to save the 50 million Germans, you know, whatever. So that's the problem with that.
Does this obsession with utopias and this longing for some kind of mythical golden age explain, at least in part, the rise of nationalism and Donald Trump? I mean, what is Make America Great Again other than a longing for some utopian past?
Yes, exactly. Well, Trump's Make America Great Again, it was a little kind of a blunt object on that. But Obama's whole thing was change. Mm-hmm. Remember? Change. Ready for change. Change from what? From the evil Bush administration. And the Bush administration is, we got to change from that Clinton administration. They all do this, okay?
Yeah.
You know, Trump's a little more blatant about it, put it on a baseball cap. But they all do this. And you know, the Greeks thought they were living in this terrible time. But before them was this golden age. And we think of the, you know, the Renaissance. And the Renaissance was, we're returning back to the golden age of the Greeks. And, you know, everybody does this. They always think it's just this other time where things were great. And if we could just get back to that. Mm-hmm. There was no such time. I like to remind my conservative friends that have a longing for the 1950s. Remember, the tax rate was 90%.
Yeah.
So are you sure you want to go? And think of how bad the television shows were and the movies. The movies were awful. When you watch movies from the 1950s, it's like, God, they're just terrible compared to the quality of films today. Even just like there's been studies on like television scripts. You know, and how simple and just crude they were compared to now. I mean, you have these shows like Lost or these, you know, never-ending shows, you know, with sophisticated script writers and complex plots that go on and on and lots of twists and turns. And, you know, they're cognitively more challenging and there's more of them. And, you know, this is all good. Now, today is these are the good old days.
Well, before we go, just for the record, Walt Disney chronically frozen.
No, that's a myth. Yep, the story is interesting there. That the Alcor opened its doors and released a press release the same day Disney died. So people in their minds conflated the two news stories. The cryonics, the Disney died. Oh, Disney's frozen. Okay. On the other hand, the great baseball player Ted Williams is frozen. Just his head.
Really?
Yeah, his head. and that he'll be brought back, you know, 1,000 years from now. And I'm sure baseball is still a popular sport. This is the thing about the cryonics thing. You know, just remember, you're frozen on the worst day of your life, the day you died.
Yeah.
As far as the state is concerned, cryonics is a form of burial. So you cannot be frozen before you're dead.
Interesting.
You have to be pronounced dead, and then they can freeze you. But before that, it would be suicide, which is, you know, technically illegal. So they can't do that. But anyway, I mean, there are answers to that. Well, you know, 1,000 years from now, we'll get to inject these nanobots that go in there and fix everything. Yeah, okay, maybe. You know, this now we're in the realm of science fiction.
Yeah,
which is fine. It's fun to think about, but you know, it's really don't bank on it. Don't miss out on what's going on now because you're so focused on later.
what's going to happen to you? How do you want to go when you go?
Yeah, my instructions and my trust is cremation. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, keep I don't have the brain. You know, I guess if one of the cryonics orgs offered me a free freeze, I might do it just for the hell of it. It's kind of interesting. It's 0.001% probability of working as far as I'm concerned. But that's, as they point out, that's better than 0%, which is what you get when you're cremated. Yeah, okay, that's true. So I don't know. It's not something I like to think of that much about. And my wife hates it when I bring these subjects up, you know, it's like, no, I don't, let's stop talking about that. Understandably. Anyway, so.
Yeah. Well, I hope we can keep you around for a while here.
I'm mostly focused on the here and now. Yeah. I do want to write more books. I enjoy writing books. So it's a fun process.
Well, I enjoyed reading this one. Michael Sherman's book is called Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for Afterlife, Immortality, and Utopia. Michael, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me back.
Thanks again to Michael Shermer for coming on the podcast. Once more, you can get his book, Heavens on Earth, The Scientific Search for the Afterlife, Immortality, and Utopia, on Amazon, or download the audiobook on Audible. For more fun skeptical inquiry, you can visit skeptic.com and visit Michael's personal website at michaelshermer.com. And you can follow him on Twitter at Michael Shermer. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod,
And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.